to the Cinephile Hissy Fit Podcast, brought to you by the Ruminations Radio Network and sponsored by Film Obsessive. This is the Tirade Film Movie Debate, hosted by two film critics, cool dads and struggling teachers. I'm Don Shanahan.
Oh, and I'm William Henry Johnson III. Zero for zero at the Academy Awards.
You brought the fancy name out tonight. This is a bit of post-Oscars talk here. All right, here we go. So, ladies and gentlemen, damn glad to have you folks. This is all for tantrum's sake, where shared passions and high fives wash away any place for hate. No matter what, we encourage you all to love what you love. But for now, the gloves are off and the hissy fit is on. This week, we're bringing to you a special editorial episode. I think this is recommended by Will. So this is like director backlash, auteur theory. Where are we going with this, Will?
Well, it is. I'm not going to lie. It's kind of patchwork, but you know, I am a little bit against my better impulses. I mean, and actually, yeah. I've had at the time of this recording on the 17th, I've had a lot of free time, and I've actually had it enter my mind a couple of times. If it wasn't for the podcast,
okay,
I might just quit social media just because it's just too much. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
okay.
I can't quit it just because I like to promote the podcast and I like to have good discussions. But one thing that was, and I'm not some kind of Bradley Cooper stan or anything. Like, I mean, I like Bradley Cooper a lot.
Oh, that'd be me over here. I'm a Bradley Cooper stan. So.
Yeah. I mean, I respect him. I like him a lot. Let me just put it this way. I have no opinion. Like, I don't go out of my way to look at like a Bradley Cooper thing and go like, oh, well, I hope this is great because Bradley Cooper's in it, or I hope it fails because Bradley Cooper's in it. I'm very... Okay.
You're neutral. Yeah.
I'm just a neutral... I enjoy his work. I think he's a great actor, right? And a great director, too.
I think so.
But one thing I noticed prior to the Oscars, and one thing that's continuing... I'll give you an example. I found something just perusing. So
okay.
Here's something on Twitter. I'm not going to call it X.
Yeah, I don't call it X.
It shows... him doing the scene in the church from Maestro, you know, where
right, he's right. Fantastic scene. Uh-huh.
And this is just an example. I think this was on Oscar night. It says, Bradley Cooper didn't win shit. We won. Or it'll show gifs of people like screaming and clapping and laughing. They'll say, Bradley Cooper going home with zero Oscars.
Wow.
Just stuff like that. And I kind of have been noticing that for...
I mean,
a long time before.
Yeah, I was very quick to be like, you know, Scorsese's 0-26 in the last 9 years of the Oscars. I was quick to bang the gong for bashing.
And the thing about I guess the point is when it comes to something like Scorsese, in which you and I feel like the minority, where we kind of have a
we kind of
have a point of why we would root against him because of the kind of not vindictive, but almost kind of like, I would almost say like, you know, the emperor has no clothes kind of feel to him where it's just like, yes, he's a incredible filmmaker. He's made some amazing films. He obviously loves movies and loves cinema. Yep. Loves
restoring the game, a savor of the art. I get all that.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. But that at the same time is willing to bring down other artists for gatekeeping. Uh-huh. And also, you know, calling out a problem that he contributes to. So
agreed.
We kind of have
a difference, but
Bradley Cooper, it seems like
I don't see him doing the gatekeeping thing.
The biggest thing that seems to be against him right now is one thing that's going on right now on the Twitter sphere is, you know, that he is this tryhard. Like everyone,
it's all right.
And I think it is, but like people have kind of turned it into like he just wants an Oscar. Like they're kind of ignoring his artistic capabilities. Okay. And they are taking like, you know, in that tweet that I just saw, like it shows that scene from Maestro where he's in the church conducting. Mm-hmm. Great scene in the context of the movie. It makes sense.
Very much so. Yeah.
It makes sense in terms of at least the character that he has created, whether that's accurate to Leonard Bernstein or not, I don't know.
Okay.
But it makes sense. But yeah, if you watch a 15-second clip of it and you attach words like try hard or dumbass or hell, he just wants an Oscar. Yeah, it can look pretty insane, right? Like it's kind of like
we had this talk with method acting where is there such a thing then as like almost method directing? Like, can you over direct something? Can you put your, I mean, he's always been a try hard actor because he's an Inside the Actor Studio trained guy. We've seen him on the show in the audience applauding Masters, you know, like, and then becoming one of his own and being a guest back on that show. Like, he's old school, you know, I mean, he's a traditionally trained actor. So he's been I mean, whether it's A-Team or Hangover or obviously a David O. Russell film, like he's completely try hard. And that manic personality that is him comes out with his try hardness. If he's taking that if he's multiplying that by doing that as a director and then putting himself calling his own number as a star, and the try hard stuff is now doubled. Yeah, that can be now. That's where the audience POV becomes tricky because, like, I don't think he's making Oscar bait to make Oscar bait. I think he finds interesting subjects that he's really inspired by, but to somebody else, it's like, oh, Bradley Cooper's just trying to do a big showy fucking thing to be really big and showy and look at me. Well, I think the audience is more narrow-minded than Bradley in that department, but
well, yeah, because
that's Twitter for you, though, that's for sure.
Because his directorial debut was like the fifth remake.
That's audacious. I mean, that's kind of ballsy, you know.
But it also wasn't like it wasn't advertised as like the revelation of our decade.
No,
like it was just promoted as a normal movie, and it ended up winning people's hearts, and people loved it. And it's just amazing that within like 3 years, you know, he's almost like a victim of his own success. Like I get it. Like
Why would you
not want to win an Oscar? I mean, like, I guess what I'm saying is,
don't we always wish when you say try hard? Like, I think we used the word try hard in the show was Zack Snyder and Rebel Moon, where you said that guy is trying too hard to do 1,000 things and make all this stuff go, and yet the results of that are so just small and stupid and inconsequential. And then I countered you to say that crazy thing is like you think it's AI and he's mailing it in, and I'm laughing at you going like no, that's Zack Snyder. That's the peak of his tryhardness, is he tries so hard and yet that's all you get as an output is Rebel fucking Moon 1 and 2. Versus now if you take that to Bradley and go when he tries his hardest, what does he make? He makes the fifth remake of a big bold film, modernizes it, makes it successful, discovers Lady Gaga for the cinematic purposes. And then here he comes with Maestro, where, I mean, I know I'm higher in Maestro than you, but like he takes a big heart, you know, larger than life figure, creates a pretty, you know, really fleshed out movie that can go with that, non-traditional from biopics and all that. But I will trade Bradley Cooper for all the other 10 people who don't try hard. Like I'll go down fighting with Bradley Cooper and the try hard people all the time versus I'll say Scorsese, a guy who he's trying hard, but he's doing it. Like I've said it on the show. He's at the filet mignon buffet where he's making a $155 movie. That's a vanity project and a half just to whatever, hold on to Old Glory, work with his friends, maybe get pick up an Oscar or two along the way, versus Cooper, who still made Maestro for, you know, I don't know, $40 to $60 million. He kept it tight, worked with good people, shot it uniquely, and I'll take that. We don't have enough try hard guys in my opinion versus the ones we're going to make fun of.
And I remember when the first images were coming out and the first clips and things. People were like, "Oh, this looks like it could win some Oscars," but it wasn't like it didn't feel like.
It's not Miramax Oscar bait.
Yeah, it wasn't. It didn't feel like Oscar bait at all. It felt just kind of like that,
you know.
It looked like something that was going to be taken seriously and would be done well, because I remember the first couple times I saw pictures of him. In the old age makeup, I was like, oh, he's going for it.
And, he's going for it.
But I didn't like see it as a bad thing. But, what might have contributed to it is, you know, he's done a lot of interviews since the movie came out.
Yeah.
You know, there's something
with the strikes breaking. Like, he couldn't touch it for a long time. And now when he finally could, he's never left the couch. Yeah.
Well, he could because he was a director. He could because the director didn't have a strike. But there were some things that were weird, like, you know, how he said, like, I don't let anyone sit down on set. I remember there was that interview with Spike Lee, and Spike Lee was like, what the hell's wrong with you? Like, let people sit down, weirdo. But I mean, that's weird. I get it. But it feels kind of like almost like, you know, he's talking to Spike Lee, who's directed 50 films, whereas Bradley Cooper's directed 2. Like,
yeah,
he's probably got some of that rookie sophomore I think that's giddiness or whatever. Yeah. And but I think a lot of people just here's a good example. Like whenever you hear this happened at the Oscars. This is a great thing. It depends on what you hear and read first. There was a moment at the Oscars where Jimmy Kimmel said when they were presenting the Poor Things like Best Picture nomination, you know, where they show clips the film. Uh-huh. And he said, hey, that's the amount we can show without it being edited for television, right?
Right.
It cut to Mark Ruffalo having a good laugh at that joke.
Uh-huh.
And then next to him was Emma Stone and her husband.
Uh-huh.
And she says something.
Yeah. And
now here's the thing. I saw that clip and it was with a tweet. And the tweet said, here's Emma Stone saying he's such a prick.
Uh-huh.
Like, so I can't help. It's like saying, don't think about a pink elephant. Like,
I know. Yeah.
I can see it in the words where it sounds like that's what she's saying. Right. But then other people were like, well, no, she's saying he's right or whatever. Like, whatever. People are not lip readers. But the point is, it's almost like kind of like those ghost hunting recordings. Like they put a sound out there. They say, hey, you can hear that ghost saying this. And then you can't get that out of your head.
I think
some point, Bradley Cooper kind of became this ghost sound where people are just like, he's a tryhard. Like, look at him. He looks so desperate for an Oscar. He's such a tryhard. Fuck that tryhard. And I know you're not as engaged in it. And this is why I hate social media.
This is me not being on Twitter. This is true. Yeah.
Right.
Because I'm on Twitter, but I'm just not diving into these places.
That is a huge, I mean, this Bradley Cooper stuff. You could type in Bradley Cooper right now and it's
all there. Yeah.
A topic of discussion right now. All those tweets I just was reading on here, that stuff that's been posted in the last couple of days. So, I mean, it's like the Oscars were last 2 weeks ago. So it's kinda, you know what I mean?
I admit that I fall for that though. Like, I mean, it's I don't want to say it's choosing battles, but like, I mean, I did the same thing. I mean, I mentioned in the opening of the show, like I was very quick to tweet, hey, Scorsese, 0-for-26. Nice job.
Right.
You know, like where he's got a try hardness that I just don't tolerate because of, like you said, it's the work ethic, which is crazy because it's Scorsese. Like we said, between like what he's done to restore and keep and curate cinema and all that. Like maybe it's that fine line between respecting what they've done but never giving an automatic pass. Like it's the occupational hazard that I do as a critic, but like no one gets an automatic pass. It's plenty of people get automatic excitement and enthusiasm from me, but no one gets a pass. You know, like if Steven Spielberg makes a shitty movie, I'm going to tell him they do it.
Oh,
you know,
absolutely,
but it's also my attitude. But some of that is the sharpness of that attitude where like when I just wrote a silly rule book, I'm in the process of writing a silly rule book for Film Obsessor with my managing editor, where we've got a couple of critics. I don't know if they hear the show and they know it's them. Sorry, guys. But we've got a lot of critics where when they write a negative review, it's just every fucking sentence pounds it and pounds it and pounds it and pounds it. There's not a lot of nuance. There's not a lot of tact. It's just what negative thing can I say next to the next negative thing? And it's just uninteresting to read. And I agree with my managing editor who says, you know, I don't want to publish these things anymore. If they're just going to, like, if you're going to be, you can give a negative review while still critiquing, you can still do a negative review while still respecting what's there. And I said it to my, he's like, hey, is there another way you could think of talking about this to our writers, Don? I said, you know what? There's one way I would say it. And this is me being a little blunter. I said, you know what? Write the review as if you were going to say it to the fucking director's face. Mm-hmm. And if you could do that with some tact and some good words, you've done the exercise of thinking more critically about something. And two, then you're, guess what? You're probably not a snark artist. Because if you were to say some of the shit you do in a tweet or say some of the shit you put in a review to somebody's face, you get fucking punched or you just get summarily dismissed and you professionally scolded. Well, that's some of that's the internet courage of Twitter being just shitheads. At the same time as like, yeah, versus like, what's a way to be like, hey, Bradley, settle down. I respect what you're doing, but you know, like versus just summarily dismissing somebody. Cause that's surely what Twitter will do all the time.
Yeah. Well, yeah. There's the, you know, tough guys. I generally try to not say anything Have I made mistakes? Of course. Like, oh, I've said things I shouldn't, but everybody does. But in general, I don't generally say anything on social media that I wouldn't say to someone's face. I just don't.
Same here. There's a lot of people who don't do that, and then they're influencers.
Well, and then, that's because they grew up without.
Yeah.
Well, because you and I come from a generation that, I know I'm technically a millennial because of the year I was born, but.
Sure.
I feel more in line with the previous generation, the Generation X or Y or whatever.
And I gladly accept you. Yes.
Yeah, because I was 82. I think millennials start in 81, so I don't really feel it.
I'm 79. I'm barely there, you know.
Yeah, so, but that said, we are one of those last generations that grew up having no internet, no social media, nothing, where you had to... You know, I mean,
you could interact with fucking people. You had to have interpersonal skills.
You could write a strongly worded letter to Fangoria or something, but for the most part, your opinions were either your own, so you had some kind of self-moderation, or the only opportunity you would ever have to say anything to anybody is to their face.
Exactly.
Or behind their back to a friend. Yeah. And it becomes a game of telephone, but.
Yep.
But now everything is so online, as they say. Everything is so like
cyberbullying.
I can say whatever I want to say,
And
there's really no consequences. I mean, for it in a way.
Yeah.
You know, sort of. I mean, you can go online now and say. I mean, if I hated Russell Crowe, I could go on Twitter and be like, "Fuck you, guy."
Yeah, you can get away with a lot of that. Well, it's to the point of parody. Like, you've seen the mean tweet segment that Jimmy Kimmel does where celebrities come on and read the mean tweets about themselves. And it's so, like, they're so gaudily, like, the tweets, the way they're crafted in form, whether they're not even clever at this point. They're just so god-awfully extreme that we can now laugh at them. Yet at the same time, someone actually sat down with all the fervor in their heart and put that down there. It's crazy.
I guess the point is, and you brought up a great thing. Something about the Bradley Cooper thing just bothered me because, like, I think that it's something in our culture, American culture specifically, and maybe British culture too, in terms of because their media culture, newspapers, tabloids, etc., is a hell of a lot more vicious than we are.
And I agree. Imagine. Yeah, those critics are hard.
So I don't know if it's something that's just an English and an American thing to do, but it always feels like we love an underdog. We love bringing people up, but we also love bringing them down.
That's true.
And it's true. It's weird because, like I said, only like 3 years ago, Bradley Cooper was the apple in everyone's eye. Like, everyone loved him.
Mm-hmm.
And now it seems like everybody hates him, you know, and it's weird.
Yeah.
And it just made me think about, like I said, I know the editorial isn't as focused as we normally have editorials, but it just kind of made me think of, like, why do we do this? Like, why do we look at someone who's trying to excel? I mean,
I have my answers to this where I think – I hate to call this a default human setting, but like maybe this is our time spent in the classrooms where I'm seeing it at our ages. I'm seeing it with children. I'm seeing it kind of everywhere at this point where, and maybe it's this top of the food chain thing that we are as a species, but like, I think man has at least to some degree, large or small, it's in there no matter what, a superiority complex. Like, we are expected to like live a pretty safe life. Like, There's no predatory things that are out there that are going to happen to us every day when we walk in the house. Like, there's shit anything can happen anytime. Don't get me wrong, but like, for the most part, we're going to live through the day, you know. And there's not a lot of like things that are really going to like invoke our fears. So like when that superiority complex kind of has us walk around playing the tough guy, you know, or if someone's a little different than me, if someone's a little off than me, or someone does something cooler than me, or something better than me, and they want to. I don't know. I'll do that in a weird competitive way. I'm not on the couch as a psychiatrist here, but it feels like that. Like, I got kids that it's the one-upmanship. Like, if they get a high score in a game, the next kid wants to get a higher score than their friend, even if they're a good friend. And there's no pat them on the back and going, "Hey, good job." I'm going to beat you next. You know, like it's weirdly competitive all the time. And I don't know why when teamwork works great and we don't use it enough. You know?
Yeah.
It's weird. I don't know. That I might be reaching for that, but.
Well, and I'll give you a comp of another industry that I see this a lot in. And actually, because this space, and I'll explain what it is in a second, is now being populated. Well, I'll just say it, like the sports industry, you know, used to be a very split. There were the athletes and then there were the reporters, right?
Okay. Yeah.
And then, you know, sometimes starting about, I'm thinking about the NBA in particular, probably about 4 or 5 years ago, players started making their own podcasts. Some of them were still playing.
That's true.
So they would play a game and then they'd have a podcast that night or whatever. Yeah. Like it was just kind of we had never had that kind of access to athletes before.
Good word for it. Yeah.
And what I find very fascinating about it is how disengaged the athletes are to the discussions that go on around them in that sphere. So I guess
where they shoot their show, they say their thing, but they're not answering the rumors and the bullshit.
Yeah. Like for example, one of the greatest podcasters out there right now is JJ Redick, former Magic player, played for the Clippers, etc.
I can see him being that guy.
He's amazing. He's great. And you know, he'll have everybody on, like, you know, because he's a player, he has access to, he's had the commissioner of the league on, he's had celebrities on, he's had all the star players of then and now, and they go on the show. And it's amazing how, you know, they'll talk about legacies. Like when we talk about legacies, it's always like, who's the GOAT? Who has more rings? Who scored more points?
Yeah.
That's
who's the top? Can't you just be the top 100 and be happy? You know,
And now, but like those players, when they talk, that doesn't even come across their mind. Like you'll have a guy that's won, another one who does a show is Andre Iguodala. He does a show with Evan Turner, who was kind of a journeyman.
But they're friends. The Hall of Very Good someday, you know?
But
Hall of Famers.
But like they never sit, like Iguodala's not sitting there going like, well, I won finals MVP and I've won 4 rings.
Yeah.
I'm a better player than you. Like the respect level they have for each other, like the way they look at the game is so divorced from the commentary around it on social media. And I think that exists the same way with movies and stuff. I think
Maybe that's Cooper, because like Cooper's not an Instagram and Twitter guy, you know, like he's probably looks aloof because he's not. Yeah, he hits the couches on late nights and he's a good interview and he's a good hang. And he's a Philadelphia guy and all that. Like, I mean, he's got enough light blue on his collar to kind of be, hey, I used to be as cool as one of you. But like at the same time, I'm not tweeting my fucking breakfast, you know, so.
Well, it's sad because
he's got an arm's length away from it while still reveling in it and smiling when he has to smile.
Well, and the sad part of it is there was always that phrase like that. It was kind of used as a joke, but, you know, it would say like, oh, celebrities, they're just like us. You know, when you would see them shopping at the grocery store.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's funny because now we have more access to celebrities than ever. We get to see them. Be human beings
for groceries. Yeah.
And it's almost like we're punishing them for being human. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like,
well, that's how I separate Cooper from being Scorsese is like when Cooper does do an interview, whether it's Jimmy Fallon or if he's on, or if he's doing the Spike Lee thing, when he talks, yes, you get the manic creator there for sure. Mm-hmm. But his reverence for the people he works with, the people he idolizes, his thankfulness level, the gratitude he has for the position he's in and what he gets to do is off the charts for me compared to the people who just kind of do press and just kind of skip an answer here, skip an answer there. Now, I think our own Barbara Vandenberg, for fellow guest in the show, she's given us a bad Bradley Cooper story where I'm not surprised that there's days they're tired and they just don't want to do it. But at the same time, like when around people they respect, their respect comes out, and that's better than no respect at all, I guess.
Oh yeah, I've told this story. I don't know if I've told this on the podcast, just because it's a sports story.
Sure.
But if I have, sorry. But if I haven't, great story. So I used to live in Tampa. That's where I was born and raised. And oddly enough, the two states I've lived in, I live in Arizona right now, and I lived in Florida, are all spring training states. So
that's right.
Spring training is like a thing we do. You do it because it's a fun activity that you can only do in those two states, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know if you remember, like, I didn't have a team growing up because Tampa did not have a team and the Florida Marlins were about 4 hours south.
Right.
So I didn't have a baseball team. So I just kind of went with whoever I liked. And at the time, I would say when I was about 93 to 96, you know, I'd watched all the major league movies as an Indians fan. Cleveland, I'm not allowed to say that anymore. I was a Cleveland Indians fan.
Yeah.
Right. And I went to all their spring training games for like 3 straight years. Just, I love the Indians. I thought they were so fun because the movie connection and
sure.
I got to know all their players, like not know them, but I'm just saying like, I got to know the rosters and who was coming up. And
you're the kid reading baseball cards. You know, everybody on that team.
Yeah. Sure. And I would end up meeting some of them. Like I remember Carlos Baerga he would drive around a golf cart in the parking lot and he would pose for pictures with fans and stuff. Anyways, I don't know if you or anyone else from that time period remember, but like one of the most feared men in baseball at that time on the Indians was Albert Bell.
Oh yeah.
Everyone said Albert Bell was the biggest asshole. He was scary. Sure. He was like, there was one moment where like he got walked and he refused to walk because he wanted to face the pitcher.
Yeah.
Like he's flipped off
a real pitch. Yeah.
He's flipped off people in the crowd, whatever.
Uh-huh.
Like he had a reputation. The reputation in the newspapers and whenever you would go to the Cleveland Indians games was always be like, oh, Albert Bell, what an asshole, right?
Uh-huh.
So I'd been to all the games. I was by the tunnel where the players come in and out. I had my Albert Bell because I had all the cards. I'd get them to sign all the baseball cards. Sure. I wish I still had them now. That'd be great. But I had an Albert Bell card and I had a Sharpie. And I went up to Albert Bell, you know, expecting the worst because everyone tells me how much of an asshole this guy is, right?
Right.
And I go, hey, can you sign my card, Mr. Bell? I'd really appreciate it. He goes, no problem. He grabs my pen. He tries to sign the card. Doesn't work.
Nah.
So I'm thinking, okay, well, I tried, right?
Yeah.
He's like, hey, do you have another pen? I said, no, I got one in my car. And this is spring training. So, you know, the parking lot's right there. It's not a stadium. Yeah,
yeah. Right.
I'm like, oh, man, I got one in my car. But, you know, I know it's far away. And he's like, don't worry, man. Just go get your pen. Come back. Right? I mean, this had to take... Regardless how close the parking lot is,
3-4 minutes. Sure.
This had to take a while to get the pen right out of the car. I come back, still sitting there waiting for me, signed the card, said, hey, man, thanks for supporting us.
How about his day?
And that day, I'm 40, almost 42 now. That was when I was like 13 years old. I still remember that. And to me, it was kind of like, the Barbara Vandenberg story. Like, yeah, she probably caught Cooper on a bad day. I caught Bell on a great day. Whatever it is, these people are human. And we tend to get blinded by the rhetoric that ends up becoming part of it's almost like a Mandela effect in a sense. It's like it suddenly becomes this person is a tryhard or this person. I'm sure there are aspects of Scorsese that you and I maybe have a bias to because of some of the things we don't like. I'm sure maybe there are some things we really like about him that we overlook or whatever, right? But
I'm sure of it.
But for the most part, though, it's like people get these things. And I guess the sports example, like the J.J. Redick podcast, the Andre Iguodala one, is that the people involved in that are so divorced from that. And they don't think on those levels. We're kind of almost plagued as a society to, especially now that we have that buffer zone where we're not talking to people like directly.
Right.
That these people don't become human anymore. And I think that
interesting.
Because when you hear the athletes talk, like, is JJ Redick bummed out that he never won a title? He's like, yeah, you know, I didn't win a title. That's a bummer. That's the highest, you know, achievement I could get in my job, but I made $115 million. I got to play with the best players in the league. Right. I have my own show. Like, and you also brought up another thing about Bradley Cooper about athletes too.
Yeah.
You know, it's always got to be who's number one, like you said.
Sometimes it could be that, yeah.
And I think that, like, this happened in football this year, too. The only way I can really apply it is sports, because arts is a little bit harder to
sympathize a winner. I'll find a way to comp this to you. Yeah, go ahead.
But like, okay, so this year, as usual, of course, the Chiefs won again, right?
They sure did.
And they turned the switch on in the playoffs because they were not really that great in the regular season. And they turned the switch on, and they beat all these quarterbacks, right, on their way. They beat Lamar Jackson. They beat Josh Allen, right?
Uh-huh.
But like the thing now is because Josh Allen has lost to Patrick Mahomes and the Chiefs 3 times in the playoffs now.
Yeah.
3 out of 3 times he's lost, right? People say he sucks.
I know, I can't do that.
And, and it's like, wait a minute, this guy is a generational talent.
I agree.
Like and one of my favorite sports commentators, Chris Broussard, he mm-hmm. mentioned something. He's like, do we discount Karl Malone and Sean Kemp and Charles and Barkley Reno. And all these guys because they couldn't beat Jordan?
No.
You know what I mean? On. Like it's we don't appreciate greatness anymore on any level unless it's
crowned.
Unless you're the one or the bottom. Like
Look at all the GOAT conversations that are showering Patrick Mahomes right now. And I'm that guy who's like, pump the fucking brakes. He's 28 years old. You know, like he's doing great. Let's see. It's like me with the masterpiece word. Like they're doing great. Let's see what happens when their career is done. You know, like
he's on the trajectory right now, but.
Oh, no, no.
Anything could happen. I mean, anything could happen.
Well, even if Mahomes ended his career today, automatic first ballot Hall of Famer. No doubt about that. But like, if we're doing the GOAT shit, we're going past first ballots. Now we're going past gold jackets. Now we're going past football cards. We're going to the fucking GOAT. And yes, he's on his way. And if he gets there, great. But somebody's going to be like, you're right. The sports analogy plays a lot because like, I'm that guy doing the Jordan thing as a Chicago defender. You know, I got my meatball in this where like, no matter what LeBron can do. You know, I'm still Jason Siegel in Bad Teacher where I'm like, you know, call me when he has six championships where I'm bragging about a crown. I'm bragging about a six way crown that Jordan has that LeBron doesn't. Yet at the same time, can't they just both be great? It's probably where I need to sour myself down to get to where I'm not a meatball and a Twitter guy either. So
yeah, and we'll go back to movies for a minute. Like,
yeah, well here, before we do, let's take a quick break so we get the read done and then we'll circle this back to movies. So ladies and gents, let's take a quick break for a short announcement from our non-corporate partners and friends.
You've seen Twin Peaks all the way through, but all you have are spoiler-free discussions? At Blue Rose Task Force Podcast, no information is classified and nothing beats the listening sensation when production history collides with deep theory. Put the coffee on.
All right, thank you. Welcome back. Yeah, just pay the bills for the podcast there.
Sure. So, a very influential filmmaker for me, who has noticeably had a dip in terms of popularity and importance in the film industry is Kevin Smith, right?
Ah, good one. You know, this can go some places. Like, I see where you're going here.
So he was an indie darling. He was a contemporary of Quentin Tarantino and Robert Rodriguez. And these guys were all friends because they all admired each other's work and supported it. And they changed the film industry. They really did. At some point, Kevin Smith, you know, decided, hey, you know what? Like, I'm a comic book guy and I've made some movies that were successful and I have a fan base where I can now write comics for a living or I can do interview shows where I'm interviewing like my heroes. Yeah.
He's got a commentary on the Roadhouse disc, him and a fan.
Oh, yeah. It's him and Scott Mosier, who's his producer, longtime producer.
Yeah.
But like people now kind of look at his. Because he makes only films he wants to make, and he finds ways to do them. We should
all be so lucky.
Yeah, well, he makes the movies he wants to make. He doesn't make them for a mass audience. He makes them on very low budgets, and he always knows how to make money. That's the thing about Kevin Smith that like I don't think people understand.
That's different from Marty. Yeah,
the fact that Clerks made $3 million on a $20,000 budget is insane.
Yeah.
That is like a profit of what, like 900% or something? It's insane. And the soundtrack for that movie costs more in licensing than the actual movie did. And he would continue to do that. Like Chasing Amy was, I don't even think it was $1 million, and that made some money.
Successful as well. Super, now, yeah.
So, but the problem is, I think, is with rhetoric surrounding it, right? Like now people look at him and say like, oh, what he could have been. Or what he could have.
I see what you're saying here.
And I'm kind of like, dude, well, it doesn't matter if he makes the ninth Jay and Silent Bob movie.
Yeah.
Clerks is still there.
Yeah.
Chasing Amy's still there. For a lot of people, Mallrats is there. Dogma's there.
Well,
there's a lot of great movies out there that he made. And that doesn't go away just because you change the trajectory of your career.
I'm guilty of doing this in a criticizing way. I do the same thing with Scorsese where there's this weird thing where like what you're describing with Smith and then what I'm going to counter describe with Marty is the double-edged sword of the quote unquote, what have you done for me lately thing.
Yeah, that's true.
You know what I mean? Like you're saying, hey, Kevin Smith will always have the big hits that he has, and he's earned his place. He broke through. He's done significant work. Yet now we don't see him do much of anything, or we question what he's up to, he's just off. Or he's not as prolific as he was at the time, or he's not challenging himself. And sometimes the critique people will do, and it's like, when you don't have to challenge yourself, why would you? At the same time as we're doing then I turn into that guy as the wool hat film critic, where I look at Marty Scorsese and I divorce the resume of like, well, it's Martin, because I've had so many people yell at me, but it's Martin Scorsese. I'm like, you're fine, but like, I'm just looking at this one movie that he has everything in his treasure chest and vault that he's done that's amazing, but just for this movie, I don't give a shit about his legacy. I don't give a shit what he's done. I'm just looking at this movie and then the next movie. So it is a weird, like, yes, they have legacies that shouldn't be discounted, but at the same time, that shouldn't be an automatic pass. Like, that's the hard hazard I have.
I think that's the difference between the two we're bringing up is,
yeah,
Smith, people downgraded because he didn't continue to make things that were as beloved.
Well, the other thing is he also didn't make, he's not making what, well, in terms of like high art, like he's making, he's making comfort food, which is wonderful. And then there's always, I do this with Bill Murray all the time. Like, classics will last longer than art. Where, like, when he dies, his tombstone will say Ghostbusters before it'll ever say Lost in Translation. No offense, Lost in Translation. It's fine, amazing work, but he'll always be that guy before he'll ever be the artist that he is after that. The greatest hits get remembered more than.
And there's nothing wrong with that either. There's nothing.
No, not at all. Like, we should all be so lucky. But that's for Smith. Like, Smith didn't make a Shakespearean film. Like, I know he's the trailblazer that he is, and he's got his contemporaries that are with him, like you said, with Rodriguez and Tarantino. But like the fact that like Tarantino has broke through and crossed over to be an Academy Award winning person. Rodriguez has never sniffed at that. And he's like Smith. He's like, I'm just making movies that make me happy. And same thing with Smith, where it's weird that people then assign expectations because you should be making the next leap. You should be making something important. Do you have to if you're just making something you like? That's where Scorsese's at, where now everything has to be of massive importance, whereas Smith never made. In snooty eyes, never made anything important.
Well, that's the other difference as well.
Stupid.
I guess my point is that because you're saying, what have you done for me lately, right?
Yeah, I do that.
Okay, I'll go
you're
back.
You're as good as your next film.
I'll go back to sports for a minute, okay?
Yeah.
One of my favorite players. I'm an Orlando Magic guy. Dwight Howard, right?
Oh.
Was a 6 or 7 year stretch where he was the most dominant physical force.
Yep.
Probably the best defensive player on the planet for 5 or 6 years, right?
Yeah.
Now, he ended up forcing his way out of Orlando. He ended up going to like 7 different teams. He finally won a championship with LA. Good for him. Happy for him. But he ended up becoming a journeyman by bad decision choices or just bad luck or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And now people just be like, yeah, Dwight Howard, whatever. Not that great. It's like,
yeah.
But here's the thing. Yeah, he's not going to be the greatest player ever. But like, we can't ignore, almost like with Kevin Smith, we can't ignore the fact that for a 5 or 6 year period, he was probably one of the best basketball players on the planet.
Sure.
And like, it's the same thing. Like, Kevin Smith was at one point one of the most influential. Good Will Hunting is not made without Kevin Smith producing.
I agree.
You know what I mean? Like, he was influential. He was impactful. He influenced. There was just as many, though they weren't as grandiose because they were more comedies, but there were just as many Kevin Smith ripoffs as there were Tarantino ripoffs.
Absolutely.
Totally. And I guess what I'm saying is that, yeah, sure, he hasn't made a quote-unquote great movie in terms of what people think is a great movie, in 20 years or whatever. But like, it's almost like we also forget and throw away the prior achievements because for some reason they're not the greatest.
Well, like maybe this is the next level here is there a level of what do you do with your fame? What do you do with your artistic leadership beyond your own work? Like Kevin Smith does that thing where like, hey, he makes his movies, but you know what? He bankrolls and he supports and he vouches for a whole lot of people to make their movies too. Versus, and then Scorsese has done a little bit of that, where he has stewarded other artists. He's been an executive producer. He's been, you know, he's bankrolled some people. Spielberg has, he's got as many hits that he's produced than he has directed, like Mask of Zorro. His fingers were in the pot of Bradley Cooper's Maestro. Like, he's got a finger in every pie in a stewardship kind of way. Of like, I've reached this level where I can find, assemble, recognize, and support talent. Who's doing that anymore versus I need to get mine? Like, who's the ball hog versus who's the, you know, the person willing to share what they've done, share their help, you know, spread their wealth. And maybe Cooper's too young to, I see Bradley Cooper doing that, but I mean, at the same time, maybe Bradley Cooper's not at the level of like two movies in a row he's called his own number, where maybe he needs to just make a movie where he's not on screen and he could be the guy, like Bradley Cooper, because the co-stars you talk to that say things about him, like Lady Gaga speaks the world of him. I've been able to ask a question where Carey Mulligan speaks the world of him, where maybe sure. Bradley Cooper needs to step away from Bradley Cooper and let other people shine. Not that he doesn't let other people shine, but at right, the same time, like give to somebody else because then they'll give back to him. Like, he's going to win an Oscar someday. It obviously wasn't for Maestro. It wasn't going to be for A Star Is Born, but his is coming. He's too good not to. Sure. Where he's going to pick the right project, balance it the right way, either show himself or show his talent. Where if it takes him becoming a director to do it, then he's Clint Eastwood instead of an actor first and a director second. You know, like nothing wrong with that. You know.
Well, I guess it comes down to. And going back to the whole thing about Cooper and people being against the fact that he's quote unquote a tryhard, right?
Yeah.
If anything, just think about any other profession. You and I are teachers, right?
We are.
If someone came up to us and said, "Man, you're really good at teaching tryhard," like think about how dumb that sounds, because it's just like,
do you want me to do the bare minimum of my job and just skirt by? Is there victory in that?
You're a brain surgeon. Try hard. Like you try so hard in college, you're number one in your class and you operate on brains, loser. Like if you take it out of the context of arts and entertainment, it doesn't make any sense.
The other thing is there are so many other extreme examples of absolute vanity that whatever Cooper's doing right now is light on the scale compared to the ego and the vanity that have come out of other people, filmmakers and actors alike, where what Bradley Cooper is quote unquote doing on Twitter or to Twitter people pales in comparison to the hubris seen elsewhere in other generations that obviously the youth and short minded just don't know or remember, because there's worse. There's so much worse.
The problem is, and Bill Maher talked about this about a month or so ago.
Okay.
On his TV show. I'm like one of the rare people in the world that likes Bill Maher. So
you got a second one over here.
Okay. But he talked about how I really identified with it. He talked about how he was talking about music. Arts and stuff. But he talked about how like art, you know, with music, and I'm sure it's not the case. It's just in general in terms of what's popular now. He was saying like, you know, 70s, 80s, even 90s, like there was something to talk about in the music. Yeah. Like they were talking about something. And then he played, now I know it's out of context, it's not scientific, but he played like pieces of hit rap songs today, right?
Okay.
And all of it was like Gucci, Chanel, like everybody was naming things, right? Like they were just naming brands, right?
I got a comp for you coming next. Yeah.
And I think that's another problem we have in media engagement with movies and stuff. And you just mentioned like the hubris, right?
Mm.
Some of these people that are revered, like the Scorsese's, the Ford Coppola's, even somebody like a Michael Cimino who bankrupts an entire studio.
Right.
Like the name is strong enough for them to be looked over, because let's look at it this way. Let's say I'm not going to say middle of the road director, but someone who's not as famous as Scorsese, but somebody who, let's say Doug Liman, who's making Roadhouse, right?
Yeah, here you go.
Let's go Doug Liman, okay? Let's say
he's got hits, he's got bombs, he's got a bit of everything on his resume.
Let's say Doug Liman's last three movies cost $200 million, lost $180 on all three of them, and won zero awards.
Yeah.
Is he still going to be having a job?
I know. Like, how many chances does pedigree get you or having a resume?
That's what I'm saying. It's like, when you say a Lyman film, it doesn't carry the weight of a Coppola film or a Scorsese film.
Yeah.
Or, and you know, this is my bugaboo, a Nolan film, right?
Oh, here's one and right there. Yeah.
So there's a couple of things with that. One is that you can't at this the way we engage in social media and branding with names is those people can't do any wrong, right?
I will judge you movie to movie where you said wrong, I'll call you for it. Yeah.
But also, I think that when you have a name, and I totally forgot what I was going to say. The point is that, that's the thing, is when you have that brand name, people become, it's simple. Like, if you go to, you can do this with something as simple as cereal, right?
Sure.
You might go down the cereal aisle and say, hey, are you a Cheerios person or are you the Publix, Cheerio, whatever. And some people will be like, I can't do anything but the name brand, right? So not only is there loyalty to a name brand. So someone's like, hey, you can't say anything bad about Scorsese. You can't say anything bad about Nolan.
Yeah.
That's a problem too, because
it's too much. Yeah.
There's no nuance anymore of saying, like Spielberg's my favorite director. Like, I know he's made some bad movies. Like,
yeah.
Metallica's my favorite band. They've made at least two bad albums. Like, I understand that, you know?
I've got two angles that go with this. One kind of goes back to, like you said, about like the name dropping things that happen in rap songs. One thing that spoils these people and then therefore spoils the industry and therefore then influences the fans is unfortunately money. You have very rich people who are making their art, quote, so to speak, in order to make more money to stay being rich people. Right. Like, those, other than the very few underground rappers who did it, straight up doing it mixtapes, like, oh, and maybe that's our generation again. Like, we came up from a place where you had to, you had to be discovered. You had to find you had to bite and scratch and steal to get where you're at. Whereas, I hate to use the Taylor Swift thing for you today, but the artists that are like consistently making stuff now, the big hit makers of the top 40, take any genre, you can go to country.
Sure.
That is just rich white people's rap, rich white people's pop. Cause they're trying to sound down home, talking about dogs and whiskey and barns and shit like that, where they don't live in those. They live in fucking mansions in Nashville. You know what I mean? Like, they're not of the people anymore, but they need to sound like they're of the people. So actors and directors, fail doing that from time to time, where like, how regular can I look? And maybe some of this is the Instagram stuff, like you said, or the access we have. Like, how can I look like I'm still one of the people? And you know what? When you're in a bow tie on the Oscar night and sitting in the front row getting rewarded for glamour project things, you don't look like other people. But here's the weird thing is like, our obsession with that celebrity culture, from the tabloids and the supermarket aisles to just watching and appreciating movies to fanboying whatever we want to fanboy, we still have those weird little American dreams of wanting that, or like, where's my $1 million? Or like, can I even get close to that? Can I connect with that, when they'll never connect with you as a regular plebeian person? The other layer of that is with, like you said, name brand reputation. Is, I like to say it like this, or I mean, maybe I just made this up now, but I'll sound like I've been saying it for years. your name will get me in the door. I'll either keep talking about your name after I leave the door if you made a good movie. Like, no, the Nolan name will get me in the door. Like, all right, Chris, yeah, I got to see that. But if I'm going to, do I keep talking about you when I leave because of what you made? That's the disseminator for me sometimes.
Well, I'm glad you brought up.
Like, I just watched a very lazy, like, I'll do a smaller level thing instead of Nolan. I just watched a Russell Crowe movie that's going to be like straight to DVD here, or like straight to streaming. It'll come out this week, called Sleeping Dogs. And I'm like, you had me at Russell Crowe. But then I watch it, I'm like, oh, okay, he is mailing it in. I'm not saying he's on Nick Cage paycheck level yet, but he's mailing it in, where like, Russell Crowe got me in the door. I'm not talking about it when I leave. And that's the problem. If I keep talking about you when I leave, you still got it. You know what I mean?
Well, I'm going to incur the wrath of the Swifties. That's fine. Whatever.
Yeah.
But I'm glad you brought that up, because this is interesting to me. This is also another interesting way. I'm gonna compare Cooper and Swift kind of applies, because she's been in movies, right? She makes her own movies now. So it's interesting that you bring that up, because Bradley Cooper is accused of being a tryhard, right, by a lot of these people.
Yeah.
Because he is going about his business. Yeah, he might have a peculiar interview, right?
Sure.
But he doesn't go out of his way to kind of say like, oh man, I really want this, or I've been working so hard for 20 something years and no one believed in me and now I'm going to, you know, whatever. Yeah. Like he just kind of,
he's not a start from the bottom lyric. You know, right. He's just like, I worked really hard. He'll say, I worked really hard to make this, not because I came from a place where I had to work hard.
Right.
Now he'll focus on the project. He's a smart guy.
Now this is where I'm going to make some people mad.
Go for it.
That's fine. I'm ready. My problem with Taylor Swift, who is now kind of a internationally revered it person.
She's Michael Jackson, Madonna. This is as big as pop culture gets. She's a crossover everything. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The one thing that I have, I'm not saying she can't write music. She writes some great songs. I enjoy some of her songs when my daughter plays them for me.
You betcha.
I have no problems with Taylor Swift as an artist. But one thing that I think the cult of personality that people are latching onto that disturbs me is the victim mentality that she's been playing since the Kanye thing.
Yeah.
Now, my problem with that is that if you ever watch interviews, you ever see entire albums that she puts out, she'll say stuff like, oh, my reputation is shot, or everyone was so mean to me and I'm this victim and I'm overpowering my haters and and that works for a bit, but that when that becomes kind of your personality, and that's what I don't understand.
Tough thing to be, because I know she's got to be. I mean, that's the plight of a female artist. Like all of that has happened to her. Does it have? And I get that that's going to fuel your art and fuel your music, but now that you've, I mean, she is so categorically won. Like
exactly, like, no, exactly. Like, so
she's. It'd be different if she has failed as an artist and she's so peak right now, no one could touch her for life. Like she's set. She'd have to do a massive scandal to ever not be. I'm just saying, like, someday in 75 years, we're going to do the list of the most influential people of the 21st century and she's going to be on it. You know,
exactly.
Like, and she's untouchable now.
But I guess what my point in bringing the two up is that somebody who's kind of minding their own business in a way.
Okay.
And they're getting destroyed for it in the public circle.
Yeah.
And then there's someone who is internationally revered at the peak of their powers.
Right.
And they're kind of allowing that. This is something I haven't liked about it. Am I saying it's a pathological thing? No. Am I saying it's a consistent thing? No. But there is something that I have by having Swifties in my house and knowing kind of what's going on and knowing history is this when you research it, it's kind of like, okay, they're playing up this certain aspect of the character that you would think if Bradley Cooper was doing.
Yeah.
They would be like, F you, buddy, for having that mentality. But like this person brought up from it. It's just weird. Yeah. It just strikes me as very weird.
Maybe that's also the disconnect of, and we say separate the art from the artist a lot. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that like how easily can that be done when, like you said, the access? Like if we separate the art from the artist with Martin Scorsese, we can watch Killers of the Flower Moon, we can watch The Irishman, and be like, and put away the Marvel bullshit, put away the dumb interview stuff he drops. You know, like can we put that away and just watch those movies and go, all right, how was The Irishman? How was Killers of the Flower Moon? Or does that sit in our heads? Same thing with Taylor Swift. Can I listen to her songs and not play the tabloid stuff in my head, the Travis Kelce stuff, whatever trigger comes with Taylor. And then with Bradley, can I take Bradley's odd little weirdness here and go, hey, let me just watch this movie and see where we're at here versus the Bradley that comes on the couch, like I said, at Fallon, you know, who's the endearing person who goes to Ellen DeGeneres and has fun on the couch. Like, is there even a real self, or is it even two versions? Like, my public persona is this, my movie persona is that, and then the real me is a distant third.
Well, no, it's a great point.
It's weird.
It's like I said, it's like if I told you to not think about a pink elephant right now, what's the first thing pops in your head?
Titties and then a pink elephant.
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. Well, with titties first, but but like it is hard to separate that. I think some people are good at doing that. Like, you know, me, dude, there's been no one that you know probably that is so like not anti Nolan, like I hate the guy, but like I just consistently do not like his films, right?
Sure.
And what was in my top five last year was Oppenheimer. I think I have.
I'm here trying to tell myself into giving it another shot, you know, 6 months later.
I think I have the ability in a way to separate that because I could easily have gone into Oppenheimer and been like, oh, it's going to be Nolan, so it's going to suck. Right. Yeah. And I went in and yes, I was surprised, but I also know I went in going, okay, this is a different story. This is a different type of film, whatever. Like I'm going to give it the solo shot. Like you said, you do with Scorsese. I'm going to do it on a single film basis.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's possible.
To loop that back to you and where this whole editorial started, cause we're getting to the end here, cause you're doing this, you're keeping this in mind as a way of just saying, hey, I want to be able to enjoy my movies. If I'm going to spend my time on it, the way you're talking about it, like stepping into the things you're trying to watch every time. I feel like I already know the answer to this question is this, cause we can, this can go back to our other editorial recently on, you know, natural versus method with like just the way the actors present themselves. I feel like the answer to this question is, I'm going to say the question, but I think I know the answer. Is this on the artists or is this on the audience in terms of like not knowledge and ignorance to the, like just knowledge and, wherewithal of like what I'm doing and what my influence is and how it's going to be taken? Or is that on the audience to be like, hey, you should probably not be taking this as seriously as you do because of like you're just watching, you know, you're watching fiction, you're watching Taylor, you listen to things like, because I think it's, you said it's the artist. I'm going to be the guy that says it's on us to not get all out of fucking shape. I'm going audience.
I don't think it's a case by case. I don't necessarily think it's the artist. Like I don't like in this Bradley Cooper thing, I don't get where all this hate's coming from.
Is there then a way to be, is there, cause I, and here I am doing the Marty thing. Like I catch myself doing it too. Like where's the consistency or like, cause now we're like, you can do the thing where like, how much Me Too are you canceling versus not canceling or, you know, like,
right.
You know me, I don't can't, for me, the most consistent thing is don't cancel anybody. Cause then you're picky and choosy if you don't.
Right.
How can we do that with this kind of criticism too? Is it just let everything be individual or have a pass or
where's the big
thesis ending to this? Yeah.
Well, we'll go with the Scorsese example. When you have someone that is decrying a system that they're willfully engaging in,
good point.
That's different than someone who is just trying to succeed, like a Bradley Cooper that wants to get an award that he thinks he deserves and does try hard to get. I mean, like there's nothing wrong.
Case by case. Okay.
And that's what I'm saying. It's case by case because going back to the sports argument, the athletes who are involved in all these discussions are not affected by it if they don't hear it because they have a totally different realm of it. I guess what I'm trying to say is there's only one Bradley Cooper, but there are 10,000 enemies and 10,000 allies. So it is the audience because
it is the audience. It's
tough for one voice to go against 3 million. Right?
No, but like, possible. But all it takes is one tweet that gets viral, and then that, and then it is all of a sudden magically one person that is tearing down another. You know, when it shouldn't even be.
Yeah.
Which is crazy that there's even that power, but it's definitely audience power.
So I guess in the end, I just was really bothered by the fact that like I was seeing all this stuff for the last 2 or 3 weeks. Don't get me started on, you know, the whole thing about, you know, Lily Gladstone is robbed because everyone's racist. I don't want to.
I don't go there either.
When I guarantee you, Emma Stone and Lily Gladstone don't even think on that wavelength.
No. Look at the way those two acknowledge and talk to each other at that exact ceremony. Like they're not in this the way that everyone else.
Right. So that's the separation is.
Yeah.
But that is affecting, I think,
the narrative, the optics.
The narrative, the optics. It's affecting how people approach movies. It's affecting how I approach movies because I don't want to think about some of these things. I just want to watch movies.
And that's where I get to be the gray beard of the bunch that says, now you know why I don't watch trailers, where I get overhyped. Now you know why I don't do a lot of interviews. I don't do Twitter. I just read a synopsis, see the people who's in it, and go, you know what? I'd like to get that a shot. Let's see how it goes. You know,
I'm getting more into that. Yeah. I'm getting more into that realm because it is just getting to the point now where you just go online now and something is just
somebody's mad about something all the time.
Real quick before I finish. There was one rabbit hole I went down today where was talking about that new David Dastmalchian movie. I think it's called Late Night with the Devil.
Yeah. Yeah.
There's a clip of it. And somebody said in the clip, there's this girl talking and somebody's tweeted. They said, Oh, that girl doesn't speak like she's from the 70s.
Oh, come on.
And then I read all the comments. They're like, yeah, the 70s, people in the 70s spoke with this certain term. Like,
oh, come on.
And it was 100 comments about how this girl is not a great actress because from she doesn't sound like she's from the 70s. Clip
on Twitter.
And it's that's the perfect embodiment of why like movies are kind of being ruined is like everyone finds something to complain about.
We do. How many, and then I'll take it to the film criticism side. How many people do we see who do what we do, and maybe what I do, whatever you want to say, who do the banal, stupid lines of, it didn't work for me. Yeah. Who the fuck cares if it works for you? Talk about the movie. Did the movie work? I don't care if it works for you. Did it work for what it's going right. for? Or it's that it's either it didn't work for me, or it's the it took me out of the movie. Okay, it took you out. How did it take the entire audience out? Because if it took the entire audience out, we can talk. If it just took you out, you're the weak-minded one that can't handle. Like,
didn't work.
Get into the movie. Put your phone away.
Didn't work for me is okay if you are surrounding it with, hey, this didn't work for me, but it's okay. Yeah. Like, but hey, it seems to work for a lot of people. But if you're just like, it didn't work for me, so therefore this movie sucks.
Thank you. That's the side I see.
I think because I've definitely said. Oh yeah, this didn't work for me. Mm-hmm. But I try to couch it with,
yeah, hey, got to
go see it on your own. Like
exactly.
You and I know too many people that are just be like, well, I heard this sucks. I'm not going to see it.
Well, and the hard part is like we're in a short form version of if journalism and criticism now, where like those are the only takes that make it are the 140 character ones that say it didn't work for me with no explanation, couching, or context, and that sucks.
Oh, for sure.
But no, my final answer to this whole thing is, we should be so lucky as to have some try hard people where I would love to have more of them. I wish everybody tried to make a movie the way Bradley Cooper tries to make a movie.
Yeah.
We see some dynamite fucking films. Top to bottom, big artists, little artists. Like, and that's the thing. Like, maybe it's me doing, like, I've been doing a lot of the indie movies a lot lately. And like, I'm not seeing Ghostbusters this week. I'm not seeing Godzilla in 2 weeks. I'm letting other people write those. Like, I'm watching the little stuff because I think one of the things that's attracting me to it is exactly what we're talking about here is, egos are out and the try hard is on, and I'm down for that. I like watching people try hard, and maybe I get that down here in the little tier of the bite, scratch, and claw level than I do in the automatic, we got our money, just need to show up blockbuster stuff.
Oh, for sure. Yeah,
I'm happy totally to swim in that lake, you know. Yeah.
Well, I know it wasn't the most organized speech, but I think we touched on some things. We definitely touched on a lot of things. Let us know, you know, comment,
please. Yeah.
Just say stuff and let us know what you think about it. Cause I have noticed, just counting myself. And I think you and I know at least, I mean, mutual friends, two or three people that have kind of quit this industry, like, because they're just like, not really doing this anymore. And it's because of the grind of it and kind of the endless,
the cyclical, just, well, Twitter, the dialogue is just not engaging. It's just spout. It's spew. Yeah. It's, I get it.
So
I'm not tempted to quit, but I'm at a point where I use my scruples sharper. That's my way of not quitting is like, you know what? Then you know what? Don't watch Ghostbusters, Frozen, whatever, and go see something you can put your 2 cents to that can use it a little
Don't
more
worry, than, I'm not going to see the Ghostbusters movie.
So. You can be proud of me for skipping it too.
Now, I won't say anything bad about it because I haven't seen it.
Until I see it. Simple as that. Yeah.
My past experiences with Ghostbuster films recently have made me not want to see it. Uh-huh. If I see it, I will give you an honest opinion.
Same.
All right, folks. Speaking of which, especially the Swifties out there who, if you're listening, are destroying me now. Cancel the misogynist, William Johnson. Folks, we now have merch from shirts to stickers. Find some sweet cinephile his fit swag on tpublic.com/user/ruminationsradio network. Follow us on Twitter at cinephilefit, on Facebook at cinephilehisfitpodcast, and Instagram at cinephilefits. Find both of us by name on Letterboxd to check out our film reviews and ratings. We are also on Rotten Tomatoes. Thank you so much for your loyal listenership in our tussles and for connecting with us on social media. Cinephile Hissy Fit is a Ruminations Radio Network podcast sponsored by Film Obsessive. If you enjoyed this show, the Ruminations Radio Network has more excellent programming with stellar hosts and spirited topics. Please rate, review, and subscribe to our show and others on iTunes, Spotify, and anywhere you find your favorite podcasts.